right, great. We've got another new show. We've got a guest that has been on our show before, and he's had some amazing information. And his name's Hugh Newman, and he's the author and conference organizer, world explorer, tour host with the Mega Lithomaniac. He's an author, and he's researched the Indigo Child phenomenon, published a book on this. His most recent book is talks about the Earth grids, and it's been published by I'm getting a mess on my computer. I'm dropping the bio, but anyway, Hugh's been on our show before, so we're just going to continue on. And welcome to the show, Hugh.
Well, thanks for having me on, James.
Yeah, what's new with you? Sorry, your bio. I had a page pop up right over your bio as I was reading it, but you've been on the show before, so we'll just go forward.
Yeah, for sure, no problem.
Yeah, pretty interesting. Well, what's new with you? What are you working on? You know, what's your most recent endeavors?
Well, I've been doing a bit of traveling over the autumn, winter months, all through the Americas, really. I got home a couple of months ago, and I'm working on my book about my local area around Cambridge, particularly a site called Wandlebury, Wandlebury Ring. And there's been some amazing discoveries there, even giant skeletons and ancient alignments, earth energies and loads of other stuff. So I'm really doing the local research while I'm here in England. But my travels have taken me all over South and Central America. I've been to Costa Rica, obviously Peru and Bolivia, Easter Island and Colombia. And obviously North America fascinates me as well as an ancient sacred landscape. Especially the Mau. We did a 6-week trip around the Mau culture sites in Ohio, and Indiana, and Kentucky, and West Virginia, and also up to Wisconsin, and that whole loop up there as well. So and Pennsylvania, and I'm fascinated by the Mau culture, and especially the giant skeletons that keep getting discovered there.
Yeah.
And they're obviously all over America, so there's a lot going on in North America, surprisingly.
Do you know the origins of these mounds and who they attribute them to, the makers of these mounds?
Well, there's two or three groups. There's the Adena, which are the older group, going back 1,000 or more BC. There's the Hopewell, who are slightly more modern, probably 1,000 or so years, a bit more later. And then there's the different Native American cultures who kind of worked with them as well. But one of the things, there's a bit of a grey area with that, really. This is something I've been in a lot of discussions with Ross Hamilton about, who's like an expert on this, and he's been researching it really thoroughly. He was connected with some of the elders there. He lives in the landscape. He's lived there all his life, really, for the last sort of 40, 50 years. And so it's a bit of a grey area who really made them. But one of the most interesting aspects to me is the fact of what they're finding there. I mean, this is just physically what they're finding, and what has been discovered is all these skeletons, and some of them are from 7 foot tall to go up to, like, there's reports of extreme height going up to 15 feet, and some even say more than that. But the average is about 7 to 9 feet tall. Some, you know, quite a lot of 10 feet. So there's this unknown race of giants. Often they have double rows of teeth as well, often with bronze armor and strange writing and unusual kind of artifacts that don't make sense in that part of North America, or in fact the whole of North America. So there's a real mystery there, because this is kind of overlooked, really, by academia and general history. And unfortunately, all the skeletons either disintegrated because they were almost like mummified within the earth, mm-hmm. or they were taken away by the Smithsonian, which is where a lot of mysteries seem to close, with the Smithsonian getting involved. And so no one really knows what's happened. But there are some photos. There's a guy called Jim Vieira who I'm friends with. He's based in Massachusetts. We're actually doing a conference over there in early October. We're going to be getting into this stuff, because loads have been found in New England as well as Ohio and the whole Southwest, California, Florida, everywhere, Mexico. And so I'm coming round to the conclusion that the mounds and even the megaliths in different countries are all kind of related to this kind of giant culture, if you like. So we need to kind of really question, you know, what's going on there and who were these people, and you know, seek the truth within it, because it's part of history, which has obviously been pretty much, they've tried to rub it out from history, which is something that myself, Jim and Ross and yourself want to get back on the map and get the questions coming again.
Yeah, I know. Even in the Bible, it says, you know, talks about the days when there were giants upon the land. And a lot of the references I've heard from ET references, as they said, some of these beings that were coming and going from the earth were up to 24 feet tall.
Yes, I've heard that, interestingly. There's actually some reports in France which go up to about that kind of height you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And in Turkey, there's been references there as well of that kind of height. There are rumours of that in North America as well. And so it's just there's not really much evidence, enough evidence to convince the general populace about this, because it's kind of being kept quiet. There's several levels to this, really. Because obviously there's the whole Middle Eastern Anunnaki connection, which I'm guessing you're referencing. Mm-hmm. But they were supposed to be giants, giant beings. There are references all through the Bible. The classic one is obviously the David and Goliath story. Mm-hmm. But most myths and legends, of pretty much most countries, have this. And we know giantism exists up to the modern day. And even when the first settlers were going over to North America, there were reports of giant cultures there then, you know, 7 to 9 feet tall. Mm-hmm. They were still living there in the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s. So that, I find that really fascinating that this is all coming out now. It's been talked about, obviously, for a long time, but no one's really kind of taken it on as a real project to kind of, you know, find the truth there. So, yes, fascinating stuff to hear.
Well, I just saw a photograph of a guy over in Afghanistan, and he was one of our troops standing next to a giant there, a living giant.
Okay.
And he was about waist high. His head came about to his waist, you know. So apparently some of those genes are still here, you know, and still operating on the planet.
Well, yeah, and I think it's been going on, and there are sort of probably DNA and different bloodlines that still have this kind of, you know, this kind of size and stature. Mm-hmm. But they're very, you know, the descriptions of them in North America, they're very powerful kind of beings, quite big kind of frames, not just through height, but just big, wide, strong kind of looking frame, big, strong jaws, mm-hmm. often with these double rows of teeth, which is quite rare. But these double rows of teeth have been found all over the place, not just in one area. But I really think people really want to check this out. There's two good sources. One of them, from people I know, Ross Hamilton, who's based in Cincinnati. He's done several books, and you can get his books through Ancient American magazine, ancientamerican.com, I think. And also Jim Vieri's got a page on Facebook where he's put in a daily giant report out, and he's found thousands of them through all the early newspapers, and he's been going to all the libraries digging out research. So, so Ross, we've invited him via Skype to our conference in May in England, in Glastonbury, in England, just to kind of give the update on all this, because it's so interesting. And Jim, we're hooking up with in early October for our Megalithomania conference over there, because he's really up to date with it, and it's a fascinating subject that needs to get out there.
Yeah, we're having some pretty crazy things going on here lately. It's just we're having these massive light ships showing up over the ranch, and it's increased exponentially. And just two nights ago, I walked out and saw something three times as big as Jupiter, you know, just light up out of nowhere and just sit there for a minute and then disappear. But I think it's all tied together. You know, it's if you read the ancient history, you know, back in the Lyrians, you know, when you get the information about the star nations, the Lyrians were up to 24 feet tall, you know, but this, you know, these things can't really be verified other than these giant skeletons that they're finding now on Earth, you know, that were part of the ancient colonies.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's a lot of connections, and no one, I mean, it's like a kind of, It's just like a sort of mystery. It kind of, it's keeping itself a mystery at the moment for some reason. Mm-hmm. I don't know why that is exactly, but it's like with many things, like, you know, crop circles and the UFO phenomenon and other things. Even the giant thing is kind of like this sort of demonic kind of reality mystery, which we never quite get the answer to, which is kind of what makes it compelling, I think, for so many people.
Is there, I know there's a lot of information coming out, everything from, you know, the Anunnaki were enlightened ones. I mean, they were extremely, very just brilliant, you know, both in technology and, you know, had some pretty unique abilities to everything, to their really negative, and they eat people. You know, I've heard all ends of the spectrum from stories. I was wondering if the Native Americans had shared some information or if you're privy to any other information kind of in that direction.
Yeah, unfortunately, yes, there has been a lot of evidence of that. There's a lot of these so-called giants are cannibals, and they kind of terrorized different tribes in North America. I mean, there's reports, there's even paintings, I think, or graphics that people drew of this many years ago, mm-hmm. Where these giant race had red hair and double rows of teeth and huge would actually terrorize and kidnap and eat people, and they were quite horrible, some of them, but not all report, you know, not all of it. It's like with any, you know, there are horrible, you know, normal sized humans on Earth. It's only a small, you know, percentage, hopefully, but, you know, it's the same principle probably. So I don't think it was a general thing, but you get the stories from the Old Testament, don't you, that talk about that, how they were kind of, even in, you know, going way back, you know, in the Middle East kind of area, that the same kind of stories came forth. They were terrorizing people and mm-hmm. killing people and, you know, kidnapping, eating them even. So there are strange kind of backstory to that that, you know, probably needs to be explored a little more.
Yeah, because I've heard different stories. I heard a lot of stories about the Anunnaki and everybody's, you know, my understanding is that they were the bearded gods. It's where we got our concept of the bearded god from the ancient Anunnaki. And they seem to be a different group. And I don't know where this other group seems to be. Maybe they fell, you know, and became primitive and just had to survive and do whatever. They were a spinoff, you know, of the original group. You know, there's so many different stories.
There is. I mean, there's like you have these. I know what you mean. That there's the bearded gods. You get all that through Central and South America, which absolutely fascinates me. Mm-hmm. You get stories like that in North America as well of bearded gods who are kind of pale skinned and bright glowing eyes, often called something in line with either the Shining Ones mm-hmm. or some brightness about them, or something to do with a serpent or a snake. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that was all connected somehow. But one of the things that you get, obviously, a lot in South and Central America is these elongated skulls, which I've been working with Brian Forrester on that, and I've found many different places where they are, you know, in different parts of the world, really. But one of the connections which kind of grabbed my attention, this was just like about 3 days ago, is a place called Sonora, this area called Sonora in northern Mexico, uh-huh. where they found these long skulls in the same place. And then I noticed some reports of some giants being discovered in exactly the same area, you know, in that part of Mexico. So there's a lot... somehow the kind of connections are drawing together between these long skulls, which there's hundreds of these skulls all over the world you can see now, and the giant skeletons, which are kind of more rare. So were they the same people, or were they two elite races? And then you had the bearded gods, and what was going on there? there's a whole area of like prehistory which we're still trying to get to grips with. And I think, you know, the evidence is now starting to come out. I think the truth is emerging slowly but surely.
Mm-hmm. I have my theory is that the Earth has been colonized many times. And from the information I've gathered is that the original program here of Earth was actually set into motion by 12 different star nations, I guess, that added their own physical genetics and the genetics of the plants and animals from their planets, and you know, that really does fit into science if you look at it, because the you know, what random mutation and Darwin's theory and things like that about evolution just don't fit. They don't add up. Things were created, And then they adapt it after that, but they never have the things in between. You know, they don't have the thing that started off as a lizard and grew a long finger and then grew mutated with feathers and then turned into a bird, you know, and they never have anything in between. They have these things that are created, and then those things did adapt and they evolved. But that just makes sense to me. And any geneticist will tell you there's just way too much diversity here for random mutation and evolution to hold true, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's right. I mean, I get blown away by these long skulls, the giants. Then you have these very small people on certain islands out in that sort of Pacific, Indonesia kind of area. And they've never, I don't want to upset anyone listening to this, but the idea of evolution is kind of feels a little bit weird to me. Just doesn't quite click. There's something kind of missing there. And I think there's something else going on that we've not really officially been allowed to hear about. So I think some of your research is probably kind of hitting that part of truth there.
I think maybe people should watch Lord of the Rings or something, and there might be a lot of truth to that. That, you know, I've always felt that civilizations have come and gone, many different ones, and the Earth's been colonized on more than one occasion. And there's been real advanced civilizations here that either because of their own misuse of technology or, you know, meteors impacting or pole shifts or whatever, you know, got pretty much wiped out or had to start over with, you know, bows and arrows and spears, basically. But that makes sense if you look at the archaeological, you know, findings, you know, throughout history, especially with Cremo's work, you know, where he found an ornate golden jewelry that's, what, 600 million years old.
Yeah, and that Michael Cremo stuff is completely out of this world, really, isn't it? That blows my mind. Mm-hmm. The more you get into that, it just doesn't make any sense. It's almost like some of it is so old, it makes you, you know, if humans were really around that long, you know, going back millions, I mean, he got to like 2 billion years old, some of the discoveries he was making.
Yeah.
And so that kind of really throws everything out, doesn't it, about what we believe about humans and about us existing here. I mean, were we therefore time traveling back then? Are humans always here? Is it always cycles of life and up growth and then destruction of civilizations and just a few survivors and it continues again? Or is it seeded, like you said, possibly from somewhere else, from a different, you know, planet even, or solar system, or other dimensional even? Or is it something else? Is it just the nature of reality? We don't quite get it, and we have this linear view on time, which is just a bit wrong. But our brains are programmed for that, so we go along with that.
I always click the D box, you know, all the above, and then you can't go wrong, because it's the same thing in the UFO phenomenon. People want to pigeonhole it, and they want to make it all either all back engineered, you know, government stuff. And I go, well, what did they back engineer it from? You know, if ETs don't exist and if there aren't alien craft out there, you know, what did they back engineer it from? And people forget that part. And then some people go, well, it's time travelers. It's us coming, you know, back from the future. And, you know, that could be correct as well. But, you know, maybe the ETs probably have time travel too, you know. And it's, you know, you just can't pigeonhole it. Some people say it's all negative, it's all bad, and some people say it's all good. And, you know, I've experienced some of these beings, the benevolent side, and it's just mind-blowing, you know, when you connect with these beings. But there's also a dark side to it, you know, and there is black ops programs and things like that as well. So I found in my research that we have to keep an open mind, and, you know, I always keep open to the D box, you know, all the above. It could all be going on at the same time, and we just can't check one box and say this is it.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I mean, that's something actually I've got that into my mind now, that what if it's all true, all of it, everything, with all these conspiracy theories, these ideas, this strange history we may have had. Maybe it's all happened at some point, you know, in different parts of the world, different times, and And I kind of like that. I mean, some people might say it's a bit of an easy way out, but actually, when you kind of open your mind to it and remove this linear time kind of blockage we seem to have, that has a ring of truth about it.
Yeah, I had I know Michael Tellinger showed me a footprint, and then J.J. Hurtak showed it to me as well quite a while back of a human being, and it was as tall as they were almost.
Yes.
And I was looking at this footprint, and I go, God, that being has to be like 25 or 30 feet tall. And they said, well, they did some calculations, and they figured out it was about 27 feet tall.
Wow.
So that does fit right into, you know, some of the ancient myth stories or things that have come down from some of the Native American stories and things like that as well.
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, when you're looking at that kind of height, although there's only kind of evidence like in footprints and the occasional bone at the moment, but hopefully more will be found as we go along, then that easily explains how they could have lifted a lot of the megalithic stones up and built many of the sites.
Oh, yeah.
And it sounds kind of weird to people when they first hear that, and I kind of laughed at that when I first heard it a few years ago, but the more I've just been noticing more and more evidence of these giant skeletons everywhere, and you know, it's you can't keep denying it. You know, that's why like Jim Vieira is actually posting every day on this Facebook page. Anyone can join it. I think it's called Stone Builders, Mound Builders, and the Giants of North America. They can all find it on Facebook. And he posts a different report going back, you know, a couple of hundred years old of these reports. These are all from America, mostly, you know, in Mexico and Canada. And there's so many now that it's like, oh, okay. you can't keep denying it. And it gives a lot of credence to how they could have shifted such massive stones. And it kind of takes away the magic of how they built the megaliths a little bit, maybe. But at least it kind of gives it might give another angle on the truth.
Mm-hmm. I've always felt that, you know, going back to the D box is that, you know, I guess five giants could pick up a pretty big stone. And I've moved stones here around on the ranch just by, you know, rolling them and dragging them and things of that nature, some pretty big stones, and set them up on top of each other. And people go, how'd you do that? You know, and
yeah,
I said, it's just leverage and, you know, and tenacity.
Yes.
I was thinking about that too, is like a lot of the stones that they've, like over in Egypt, you know, a lot of these massive stones that they're looking at, it seems like they're exposed to extremely high heat, like five or seven, I think it was around 7,000 degrees.
Oh.
Which in my meditations, I had an experience, it's a long story, but a lot of my lies were all revealed to me, and I watched them, I observed them after an intense contact that I had. But I actually saw how these things were created. A lot of the stones were actually cut, you know, with lasers, and they put a device on them that used sound. And it raised the frequency of the stone, and just one person can pick these things up and spin them around and move them and put them into place.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and they would actually, they would just kind of mold into wherever they put them. It's kind of interesting, you know, watching that from, but, you know, that's not empirical evidence. I mean, I can't prove that, but just observing that and some of the things that happened with me, you know, giving me the ability to go back and look at these things, it's pretty crazy. And I know some other people that also have those same abilities that are bringing back the exact same information, and without even knowing each other, I don't even know these people, and they're coming out with detailed information.
Yeah, I think just jumping back to you mentioned the D-box as well regarding the giants. I mean, if you look at there's two things here. If you look at Coral Castle down in Florida, which I visited this time last year,
mm-hmm.
I spent a couple of days there, really, and this guy, Edward Liscownian, who's 5 foot tall, and back in the 40s and 50s, he built this megalithic temple, homestead, really, and he moved blocks weighing up to about 30 tons alone without any electricity and just with wooden which were bits of wood, rope, and pulleys. And some of the carving was quite incredible as well. And then there's another angle on it. It's like you look at these long heads, these elongated skulls that have been found everywhere now. Mm-hmm. And even the giants, because they've got bigger skulls, they've got bigger brains, and possibly a more powerful pineal gland. And so therefore, they may have had maybe better at telekinetic kind of levitation, being able to move things with their mind. And it's something that obviously happens, people can do, it's been shown, you know. You have these psychic children, these indigo kids that could do that as well, which is something I researched, 10 years ago. And so if they've got this giant kind of forehead and they've got, maybe that was part of a race that had that power. And I think there's something that, that whole ESP phenomenon, in relation to the building of these ancient sites, something else that needs to, possibly be looked at a bit more.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know scientists right now can levitate things with sound. They've already proven that. And so, my brother always says that science is a failure of spirit. It's like, so it's kind of funny because, we have cell phones, but we do have the ability to talk telepathically, so we use the phones as a crutch because we don't want to develop our spiritual abilities. But I think about that, if we did have an extremely advanced race here, that had developed these abilities, which have been proven, telekinesis, all these things, telepathy, all pretty much have been proven to exist, probably be no problem for them to either even manifest a block if they needed to out of the ethers. There's a guy, I'm trying to remember his name, but he was using radionics, and he was saying if you pulse the radionics and you hold the image of what you're trying to create, and he said you could actually bring things straight out of the ethers into existence. And I had him on my show a while back. I'm just brain farting right now, but I'll think of him. But if somebody had that kind of technology, or even the mental capacities, because they have extremely large heads, and massive brains, and they're not separate. Their brains are totally connected. They don't have that. Is it the parietal bone they call it? I can't remember what it is on them. They're just, they would definitely have some pretty fantastic abilities.
Yeah, that definitely makes a lot of sense. I think we have these latent abilities, really, and unfortunately, many people I know just brought up watching TV and going to school, and that was it, really. Playing a bit of football with my dad, and you don't get, I think in ancient cultures, in more shamanic cultures, which I believe a lot of the world once was generally, you get brought up and be taught these very powerful tools from a very early age. And as a child, there's no blocks there, are there? There's no mental blocks to what you can and can't do. And so I think we had a whole different type of human existing on Earth for many thousands, if not millions of years, according to Michael Cremo. And so that's definitely something that we've kind of, I don't think we've lost it. I think we've just not allowed it to grow within us, and there's no kind of cultural context for it, where kids and young adults are being trained and brought up with using these kind of skills. And I think that's a real pity. I think that needs to change. I think that's something that I did quite a bit of research on in my Psychic Children book, and went into that, and now that kind of applies really to the problem of consciousness that we have now. I mean, there's a lot of people waking up. There's been a whole 2012 thing where people were really sort of looking at that as a time of change, but I think we've got a responsibility as adults in this world, our generation, to kind of bring that kind of thing back to the public consciousness and encourage that. I think there are kind of schools that do that. There's the Steiner schools and others. But generally, it's just pretty much, constant dumbing down, ridiculing everything. And if you have a psychic flash or an inspiration, you generally get put down and told to shut up if you're a child. And so, yeah, that is a problem. And I think not developing these abilities is actually something to be looked at. And I think the same problem lies with this lack of knowledge and understanding about shamanic cultures and using natural psychotropic plants to develop oneself. I think that's lacking, and I think there's many kind of problems that people have because they've not been brought up like that, which is what the tribal cultures, you know, certainly probably would have done.
Yeah, I know that they. I know a lot of times when people use like a drug or a plant or whatever, and they get blasted into these levels where they're creating, you know, instantly in the mental planes, whatever you think you're manifesting, and they've had no preparation for that. I've seen people have some pretty crazy trips and actually get pretty messed up by it. You know, especially if it's not done in a very sacred way, you know, with somebody that can pull you back, you know, or help you, you know, in your process, or whether somebody that's very well trained in that area.
Yeah, this is it. I mean, you know, growing up where I did, and in my teens and early 20s, it's just, you know, LSD, there's all these different things. You don't know what you're doing, you're just hoping for the best. Yeah. And obviously, you know, people are called to that. That's a calling to expand their consciousness and experiment in these kind of ways, because obviously, if we wouldn't be doing them if we didn't have a receptor in the brain for them. So I just think that needs to be looked at a different way. I think this is a big topic at the moment. People are kind of, it's coming up for a lot of people, this. You know, just get blown into the hypersphere or whatever, you know, when you're not on our own with a bit of LSD. And actually, it needs to be controlled a bit more, and people need to have teachers and guide, a bit of guidance with it. And I think, you know, I think that's missing in life as well. General life, there's no rites of passage anymore, apart from like your 18th, your 21st, your 40th, and your 50th birthday, pretty much. And so it's just like, that's just like a celebration and getting drunk. It's not really a rite of passage. So there's something going on there, and yeah, maybe it's changing. Maybe there's communities and awareness of this kind of stuff is changing.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I've seen a lot of the and it's kind of like sad in one way, because I've seen a lot of people have major openings, you know, doing a lot of different ceremonies like ayahuasca ceremonies and things like that. And you know, basically the original way you do ayahuasca is you go out into the jungle and you have a shaman and you're in a very natural, you know, setting, and, you know, you're out in nature and things like that. And you did it like maybe, you know, once a year, you know, that was, you know, as a rite of passage or something, you know, as an opening. And what's sad is I've seen people doing it as a recreational thing just over and over again. And then I look at their fields and they got all these entities stuck to them. And all these people jumped in because they never learned how to heal unseen negative influences or you know, have a little spiritual discernment and maintain their self-authority.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's one of the sort of problems with it. I think it's just become, even ayahuasca, I think, has become like a kind of business. Even in Peru and the Amazon area, it's very business oriented. But at least, you know, with the right kind of teacher or shaman or person who's there looking after you, then you get a bit more protection, a bit of safety with it. And but I think, you know, people who are experienced with, you know, that kind of thing, psychedelics, and can know how to look after themselves. So there is, it's just some people get blown away by it, because it is a very powerful medicine, and not to be messed with, really. You know, she's doing a world tour. She wants to see the world through us everywhere, not just in the Amazon anymore. So. So I think it's a two-way thing. It's not just us experiencing her. I think it's her experiencing us. She wants to see the world through our eyes.
Yeah. Yeah, boy. Maybe she'd be better off staying in the jungle.
Maybe she'll retreat back there when she realizes how messed up is out here. I think, you know, I think this kind of, you know, awakening, I mean, it seems like there's been eras, haven't there, of different sort of medicines as such. I mean, back in obviously the 60s, the late 60s, there was the whole LSD, and that opened up the whole mind, the whole consciousness, and created this kind of revolutionary feeling. That kind of died down in the 70s, and in the 80s and 90s, ecstasy or MDMA came out, and that really helped a lot of people who felt kind of pretty down and depressed, bored, really opened their hearts, and they were actually really became really loving and compassionate to their friends and people they just knew. There's a classic story, like, as in England, we had these football hooligans, you know, and Cambridge, where I was from, was a big thing for that. And they were all taking coke and alcohol and getting fights and really nasty violence, organised. And then the ecstasy started coming in from Holland. And next thing you know, all the they were hugging each other, going to parties together after the matches. And there's no fighting for like 10 years. And then the ecstasy got gradually worse and the fighting started again. So and then another wave came in the 90s and the 2000s really, which was like what we've just been talking about, the ayahuasca, which I think opens up the soul. So we've had like different, you know, in the 60s, 70s there was the LSD that opened up the mind, 80s and 90s ecstasy opened up the heart, and in this era we're in now still, I think, we have ayahuasca and similar things opening up the soul, and I think it's needed as a general kind of human, need. It's not just a lot of us needed to have that because it's so suppressed in society. We need to kind of explore that ourselves. And even if it is, it can be, like we said, it can be a bit much for people. At least it's getting out there and it's affecting and it's changing things and helping people with what they need help with.
I know there's natural ways of doing this, and we try to focus on that, but most people just won't take the time, you know, to do their spiritual practices and, you know, open up their sacred senses and things like that. They, you know, because we do live in this, you know, McDonald's drive-through world right now. But, you know, it's like our main focus is using, you know, inner sensitivity training, you know, techniques, learn how to heal unseen negative influences, and a lot of, you know, deep meditation practices here, and then you're solid. You know, you have a good spiritual foundation to deal with, you know, anything that comes along in these other planes and dimensions. But again, that's unfortunately right now, very, very few people will make the commitment or take the time to do that. And I've watched, I don't know if you've seen it recently, but I am just inundated with emails and, phone calls, people very close to me, people I thought were in really solid relationships, splitting right now, and just everything is coming up for them, all their childhood stuff, you know, especially if there's any trauma, you know, around abandonment or molestation or anything like that. It's just popping before they could suppress it and hold it down, and it just came up, and then it got expressed. It gets expressed in the outer world on their mates and things like that. Both male and female. And then when that energy is going on, all that chaos and fighting and anger, it draws to you these other unseen negative influences, you know, some of the regenerate ETs and demonic type energies and some things like that. It's just a big mess going on right now. So it's almost like, maybe it is a good idea for people to start opening up to actually see what they're playing with, you know, to make sure, see what kind of energies they're entertaining and what is connecting to them.
I find it really interesting that you say that, because I've that has been happening in mine and very close friends and family, people I know. And it's almost like everyone was expecting that in 2012, really.
Yeah.
All this kind of stuff to happen, so they have to really purify themselves before the end of 2012. But actually, it's going on. And actually, I think the post 2012 kind of phenomena is actually, people thought they were out of it. They thought, okay, I'm fine now. Everything, we survived, we're fine. But actually, this is now when the work needs to be done. It's a similar philosophy with ayahuasca, isn't it? It's like, I've noticed where people I know take ayahuasca, they do it a few times, you know, it could be a lot of times, it could be a few times. And actually, it's one of the teachings I think of it, is that it actually, it brings out the soul so much, your soul becomes you a bit more, and it allows the soul to grow a bit more. And the soul doesn't, you know, in the higher realities, it doesn't need a sort of partner as such, you know, but in a different, you know, in the material world, there are obviously soulmates and things like that. So there's different ways of looking at it, but I think you're right. I think like the veil is thinning. I think the energy is getting in. We're going to start becoming telepathic a little bit more. The psychic qualities are going to come forth. And I think this is all represented in what we're developing with technology, which we, mm-hmm. we could have been developing the inner technology, which is what you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
And so it's the same, you know, I think what we see in modern technology is actually what we could be developing within ourselves. And so obviously we have the worldwide communication thing is amazing. People take it for granted now, but it's amazing. Just speaking with you on Skype, on a computer, even on a telephone, which is, you know, decades old or 100 years old or whatever, it's still an amazing technology, which we can develop within ourselves. But like you say, it's the gimmick, it's the convenience. Some people like to hide behind it, makes them feel comfortable. And so, yeah, there's a lot of things we could be doing, but we're too busy. That's the nature of the capitalist world, isn't it?
Well, you know, I wrote an article about that, and I call it the Archon Network. And there's a reason why we're too busy, because we're operating within that network. And the network is generated to keep everything external, you know, to keep you go, 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 and trying to adjust to society. I talk about Krishnamurti. I love what he said. He said it's no measure of health to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society. But you know, we look at the wars and the diseases going on here, and the greed, the unbridled greed, and all these other things. But you know, we still want to be accepted and approved of by society, and until we break that program and that old program and step out of it and get into these higher realms and get aligned with soul and spirit. And if we continue to run on the ego and the programming that the ego has been subject to, we're just in this never ending, you know, rat race or whatever you want to call it, that is just, it's going to end up in total demise. But that's what I'm seeing. There's a fifth dimensional energy coming in, an overlay that's coming in, and it's tearing down that old grid. And the old grid supports the external, the see me, dig me, you know, outer appearances, acceptance and approval out of yourself, outside of self, all that stuff, externalizing everything. And in order to get through this time, we have to break away from that and get into nature and start becoming internal and hook up with our soul and spirit and find out what our unique soul purpose is. And get on that train, because the other train's going to have a huge wreck, and it's right around the corner, because the old 3D construct and the Archon network is being unraveled as we speak. It's falling apart.
Yeah, I hear you. And this is an interesting point, because it kind of fits in with what I believe is why people are so called and so compelled to start visiting ancient sites, megalithic sites and pyramids and mounds and things like this, because we've lost that sense of who we are a little bit, I think, in this modern world. And so we've got a calling, a kind of yearning to know who we are. And the only, you know, because history has been so controlled by the whole Christian and other religions, a lot of the good stuff's been literally burnt in the fires, and literally destroyed and suppressed. And so the only way we can really reconnect with that is to actually go back to these sites. And I find it really interesting that more of these sites are being discovered. I mean, look at Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, for instance. There's sites being discovered in England, up in the Orkneys, that are major megalithic sites. There's more discoveries being made literally all over the world. In Egypt, they're finding more pyramids. In Mexico, they're finding more Olmec sites that people just in their back gardens hadn't noticed them before, and things like this. And people have this calling. That's actually one of the main reasons I got so involved with this whole project or this conference and tours we do for Megalithomania, because people want to get to these sites. They want to go to them. They want to talk about them. They feel a connection with the other people who are into it as well, even. You know, as though they may be, you know, past lives or some karmic connection there. And so that's what Megalithomania kind of is, really, as well.
Yeah.
That's why I have mental thinking reasons why I do it, but there's something else going on much further inside, much deeper, which I don't really kind of understand with the mind, but I'm compelled. I think that, you know, the name Megalithomania or Megalithomaniacs makes sense because you have this pull, you have this kind of calling and yearning for it, and you know, I think there's something that is happening right now, and people really want to explore that.
Yeah, I agree. I know that metal and stone, especially stone that has a lot of crystal in it, holds energy and it holds information, and you can go there and actually access that information. And a lot of us in our past lives, you know, lived in those areas, participated in either ceremonies or even the building of some of these major megalithic sites. And so when we go there, it triggers a memory, and you can actually on a soul level get the big downloads, you know, from the statues and from the structures and whatever is left there. So, and once that happens, you know, your life's totally changed, you know. So I have no doubt at all, you know, that this is a really kind of a divine mission, you know, to get people opened up to their higher selves, get them out of the old body and personality program into a much bigger picture of themselves.
I also, following from what you're saying, I also think that these sites are some of the only places left actually have the earth energies and the underground water and the telluric currents and the intention still within them that the ancient builders created there. And I think that's what people really appreciate. They don't know it mentally why they want to go there, but they go there because they know it's almost like a pure, like a sacred space. Mm-hmm. And I've just been with my friend Sean Kerwin, who's like an expert geomancer and dowser. He calls himself Geo Repairman, which is quite a cool name. And we've been out at Wandlebury, the site I'm writing my book about at the moment, and we keep finding these areas within the site, and we found this at many other sites all over the world, really, that there's like this neutral space you get at sites, where you have all these grids, these Schneider, these Curry and Hartman grids, which are quite tight, kind of, you know, crisscrossing grids. But at these particular points where the centre of the site is, or it kind of stretches out this circle within it, and none of these grids get in, and it's like a pure kind of space. And all that's in there is like natural earth energies and sometimes natural underground water. And that's kind of the pure kind of energy which people require. And so often, sometimes they're on fault lines, sometimes they're on two different types of geology meet, like what's called a conductivity discontinuity. And sometimes they're layers of chalk and organic and non-organic materials, which create a kind of what, you know, Wilhelm Reich called orgone energy, but yeah, Now it's many different names. And this was part of the old system, the geomantic system of how they created and maintained this enchantment within the landscape. And they didn't do it just at one or two sites. They did it across entire continents. And obviously the modern building methods and road building and things like this don't account, that take anything, this kind of geomantic principles into account. They do still in the Far East, in China and Japan, they still have Feng Shui is a very big thing there, and rightly so. But it was always, even Feng Shui was always originally about landscapes and about almost like towns and countries. It wasn't about putting that flower pot on your windowsill to bring you luck or anything like that. It was nothing like that. Mm-hmm. It was a much bigger thing. And now it's being personalized into individual homes, which isn't its original meaning or philosophy when you start reading up on it. And so these principles, although still prevalent there, aren't so much here. And we've lost that. I think that is one of the problems as well in society, where we've lost, you know, we don't get trained in geomancy. We don't understand it. All the elemental beings, all the elves, sprites, fairies, gnomes, whatever you want to call them, all the different elementals, have been shoved away. They've gone underground. They've disappeared because they don't want to. No one's communicating with them anymore. No one's taking any notice. No one even believes they exist.
Yeah, we're actually photographing them here. we do. We lay everything out here, you know, using sacred geometry. Divining rods, and we ask the nature spirits what to do, where we can put our buildings, you know, what's the best place. Whole place has been laid out that way here, and we have a very close connection with the nature spirits. And, you know, we're growing food that other people can't even grow up here, and it's you know, three times bigger and more, you know, filled with just energy and vitamins and So
yes.
Yeah.
This is brilliant. This is exactly, you're like one step ahead of the rest of the world, really. I mean, this is one of the big things that we need to be doing, you know, because it's like, I mean, you mentioned the food thing. Look at what we have to do with the food supply now. I mean, we have to pump it with chemicals, we have to destroy the soil, GM crops, all this kind of stuff. And I've been communicating with a guy called Patrick McManaway, and he's another expert geomancer, and he's been working with farms all over the world. And what he does, which is kind of similar to what you said, he communicates with the nature spirits to actually encourage the plants to grow and for the energies to be perfect. So it creates the environment. So they're actually, it's almost like they're helping the elementals, the different nature spirits, actually helping make the food grow better and more abundant, like what you said. And so this has been, and he's getting amazing results, and now he's getting hired all around the world to get the nature spirits back. And and actually it helps food production. So it's like, hang on a sec, what's going on here? This is, so there are things happening like that, which I think is very inspiring, and something that we actually talk about, obviously, at our conferences and on our tours. We kind of get into that kind of thing. We try and go more into the geomancy as well as getting excited by massive megaliths. So there's so many different angles to, you know, explore this with.
Yeah, we found out here that you know, we'll actually sit down, and you have to get outside the box, because when you're laying out your garden, you know, it may not be in a square. You know, they might want you to make a triangle or a circle or something else. And so we lay out the garden, and then we lay out the rows of the garden, you know, okay, which way do the rows go, you know, and we lay them out. How big are the rows? And we get those done. And then they actually tell us what to put in each row. And at the end of it, you create, what they told me is that you're creating a harmonic chord. Because every plant has a frequency or a vibration to it. And when you get the harmonics right, everything just supports each other and just grows in a phenomenal way. You know, it's like, you know, I was pulling beets out of the ground the size of cantaloupes, you know. And they weren't woody either. They were still good. You know, they were still edible.
That's incredible. I mean, this is it. I mean, there's been some other tests done. I mean, you get some, you know, some one aspect of geomancy works with the nature spirits, which is what my friend Sean Kerwin does brilliantly, and Patrick McManaway. And also there's a whole other angle, which is the whole kind of, we're actually working with the earth energies there, and the telluric currents and the underground water, and sort of creating a network across different farms and things like this. So there's different approaches, but I've actually been in quite deep discussions with my friend Sean about this, is how that perhaps these earth energies, which people are dowsing, they're finding going across the landscape, and not to be confused with ley lines. Ley lines are just straight line alignments. Sometimes they have energy associated with them, but not always. Mm-hmm. But these earth energy currents, the famous Michael and Mary lines are good examples in England. We're coming round to the realization that they are actually they are actually the elementals themselves. Mm-hmm. It's actually what they are.
Yeah.
And they manifest to us in different ways when we have often at certain power spots where the energies are a certain way. So it actually stimulates and affects our pineal gland or our consciousness. Mm-hmm. And we see them in a way that we can understand, which is like in human or fairy or elf or whatever form. So they have different forms. They're not necessarily a certain form like us humans are, which we're in the physical realm. This is like the demonic realm or the otherworldly realm or whatever you want to call it. So me and Sean have been working on that. We did, we're 2 days out on the land. We just got back yesterday. Just trying to kind of get our heads around this, and you can't really get your heads around it. It's more like you have to feel into it.
Yeah, yeah.
And get a sense of it.
You'd have a field day out here if you came out here, because we call them orb highways. And,
okay.
And, you know, we take an infrared light and night vision goggles. We have third generation military goggles, and you light up the field and you look through these goggles and you just see this highway of orbs going by. And, you know, obviously they're following a track, you know, some kind of a ley line or an energy line. But
yes,
we've been doing a lot of research with that.
It's just like, I think if you get this in Britain and Europe, especially in Ireland, actually, you have this whole idea of fairy paths and spirit roads. There's also death roads where spirit, you know, dead spirits travel down. There's fairy paths where there was this line, they would actually have to kind of, if it went through a house, they'd actually have to leave the doors open at night. Because if they didn't, there'd be disturbances and things knocked over in the house if the fairies and the elemental realms weren't allowed to move through it. And they'd actually cut corners off houses even to allow the energy, the spirits to move through. And this is still, some of this is still going on in Ireland. And we're actually going there in August to kind of do a sort of megalithic tour there. But we're going to be looking at, see if we can find some of these fairy paths and legends and alignments and see what we come up with there.
I've heard stories about they'll have these fairy mounds and they want to put a road through there. And so they'll put this road through there and they'll bulldoze them out and then they'll come back the next day and the mounds are back.
There are a lot of stories like that. Well, I think this is the problem with progress, in inverted commas, really. It's like, it's to me, it's not really, you know, a lot of people realize that's not really progress. It's just a new way of doing things that doesn't take into account what they should take into account. And Ireland, there was this whole Hill of Tara thing going back, probably about 2007, this all kicked off, where they wanted to build this highway through the whole Tara landscape, which is, you know, incredibly ancient, megalithic and mound landscape. And they kind of got away with it in the end, but you could sense that the fairy realm, who are kind of holding on there, you know, they've been kind of banished out of England pretty much, but they're holding on in Ireland, are kind of, they've just been trying to destroy that and suppress that. And I think, you know, the Christians have got a lot to answer for, because they didn't really care for it too much. They didn't take it into account. And now, you know, as well as burning all the books and, the, you know, the old scrolls in different places around the world, they've actually driven out the elementals who are there to work with us and to help us. And, you know, and it's a co-communication, you know, project really going back thousands of years, which is now, you know, been semi-destroyed. So it's a pity, really. And again, I think, you know, like you're doing at your place, James, and like the people I know in communities around here, and what me and Sean try to do is that, you know, we want to try to bring these old ways back, reintroduce them through, you know, we talk about it obviously a lot at our conferences and our tours and our events, and we get on radio shows like this. You know, and I think it's just a natural thing. People want that. They want it. They want to go back to these ways. They don't really want to be controlled by society and what society thinks and, you know, fashions and all this kind of rubbish. They want to kind of, they want another, they want something else that, that they know they had thousands of years ago. And this is the calling. We get back to the ancient site. So, I think there's a lot to think about.
Yeah, I think it is important to bring back the old ways, you know, and realize, you know, actually, you know, make amends for some of the damage we've done. And because, it, you know, the society that we've built, especially the cities, are dead. And there's so much psychic turbulence there and energy and even, you know, everything's almost become so processed and synthetic, you know, the world we live in. We're, I think Chief Seattle said it clearly. He said, you take a man out of nature, you harden his heart. And that's a very serious epidemic going on right now. Hey, we're hitting the end of the hour. So what is the best way that people can get in touch with you if they want to check out your, any of your works and your adventures coming up, any of your new tours coming up?
Well, sure thing. There's a couple of ways. Well, megalithomania.co.uk. Megalithomania. Yeah, people can check that out. They can go to, I've got a page there. They can reach that through hughnewman.co.uk. Just hughnewman.co.uk. We also run a project called Avalon Rising, and that's avalonrising.co.uk. And we've got, yeah, obviously, you know, we organise these Megalithomania conferences. We're doing one in May, 18th, 19th of May in England, in Glastonbury, with Robert Schock and a bunch of amazing speakers from all over the world. We do day tours out to all Stonehenge and Avebury and all that. For, we do like 7 days, really, non-stop. It's pretty full on, but great fun. And we're doing a bunch, we do regular tours. We're doing a tour to Ireland in August, to Turkey and Baalbek in Lebanon, Bekele Tepe and all that in September. And we work with Brian Forrester, and we do tours to Peru and Bolivia every kind of November, October, November. So we're doing all that this year. We're coming to America, so I know you're quite a long way from where we're going to be. We're going to be in Quincy, Massachusetts, which is just on the east coast there, just inland a bit, south of Boston area. But it's a beautiful historic town. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on there. We're doing a big conference there on the 5th and 6th of October. With John Anthony West, Robert Sharp, John Martin, and Jim Vieira, who I mentioned earlier, myself and a few others. And we'll be doing tours to the New England sites there. There's a lot of megaliths up there, which fascinate people. And the energies up there are very interesting, because often these chambers and sites are not necessarily really being touched or, you know, manipulated by anyone. They're still sitting there kind of almost undisturbed. So often you get a very pristine kind of energy at the sites in New England, which is very exciting. For us megalithomaniacs, we want to kind of feel the energies and do a bit of dowsing and see what's going on there. So, yeah, but the websites are really hughnewman.co.uk, and that goes through to my page I've got at the back end of the Megalithomania website. And, people can get in touch with us through them, and we're busy with lots of interesting projects and tours and talks, and, got a lot going on.
Hey, well, you know, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. I wish I had a two-hour show. I don't on this one, but I know we can go a lot further. But we'll be in touch, and I know there's a lot more information we need to cover.
Sure thing. Thanks so much for having me on, James. I really enjoyed it.
Great.
It's good.
All right, this is James Gillen signing off. Have a great day.